Hello, and welcome to the I Don't Know What I'm Doing, This Might Get Interesting podcast. Today my guest is Joe Poladin. Joe is a colleague of mine, a propulsion engineer. For those of you not in the industry, that means he is a rocket scientist. I thought it would be interesting to talk with Joe, as he is not what you might think of when you first think of a rocket scientist. Although we both work in the space industry, I find we often talk about some of his other interests. Joe is a fitness enthusiast, inventor, and entrepreneur, having designed and manufactured his own line of workout equipment. And although picking up heavy things and putting them back down may not be rocket science, this might get interesting. To give some background, you're an aerospace engineer,
Aerospace engineer, yep. With a bachelor's and a master's.
And you do mainly propulsion?
Propulsion, fluid mechanics. Yeah, the master's is in fluid mechanics, and so that led into propulsion after that.
And you work in rockets.
So yeah, solid rocket motors specifically.
You are a rocket scientist.
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah, so this year, big year for rocket science, in my opinion, here in America at least. Mm-hmm. We're returning to manned spaceflight.
Sure.
So kind of what's your thoughts on that? Too long a time coming, or?
I was amazed by the SpaceX flight. That's what you're referring to, mm-hmm. with the two astronauts there. They made it look incredibly simple, mm-hmm. and it looked so much more futuristic than the space shuttle. So much easier of an operation.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a more limited spacecraft than the shuttle is, but
yes and no. I mean, yeah, it doesn't have the cargo capacity of the space shuttle, but nothing really does. But I thought it was interesting it looks futuristic. Like it did look like
the heads-up display, the monitors, the computer stuff. That was amazing.
It looked like it was cutting-edge technology.
It did.
Which I don't think in the space program we have seen cutting-edge technology in I don't know how long.
Apollo and the space shuttle, they kind of look the same. They had all the same analog gauges mounted all over the place in the cockpit. This looked very clean. It looked like really just a Tesla is what it looked like to me. Yeah. Inside. It makes sense, obviously, under a Tesla.
And so do you think that has to do more with the culture or with the contracting, the way that they did that? So, like, are you aware of how they have changed the contracting for that?
Not so much. Not so much plugged into it.
So, like, here's an interesting – what I thought was interesting. So this was a commercial flight, and I think Jim Bridenstine, whatever his name is, the NASA –
Yeah, NASA administrator.
Administrator. He said, so this was to crew transport as a service or something like that.
Right.
So I'm not sure that NASA owns that asset.
Yeah, I don't think they do. It's a SpaceX owned asset.
Yeah, and so they're just so like in the Apollo program, NASA said, "All right, here are our designs.
Yeah. Same space shuttle.
You go build it."
Right.
To the contractors. And this time NASA was like, "We want to send 7 people to low Earth orbit and be able to carry, so much cargo, go make it happen."
Right.
And so as long as they met their milestones, they did it. So all the design choices, I think, were SpaceX's in this.
Yeah, and I believe that's correct, And SLS kind of seems like a hybrid one. It kind of seems to have that contractor kind of influence, but also more of a stronger NASA influence when you look at the vehicle, the Orion vehicle,
mm-hmm.
versus the SLS main core and all the different components of that rocket.
Well,
it seems like kind of a mix.
The SLS, that's our heavy lift vehicle,
That's right. To go to the moon and beyond.
And it's based off of shuttle technology, I think.
It is. Yeah, so it's 2 solid rocket boosters, the same ones you used to work on.
But I think they're 5-segment.
They're 5-segment. Yeah, they are 5-segment, and it has a huge. I don't know if you saw the picture of the core rolling out of the Alabama facility.
Yeah.
Just a mammoth-sized vehicle. I believe it might be the biggest vehicle ever built.
Oh, sure.
Bigger than the Saturn V, by quite a bit.
Yeah, and so with this new level of autonomy that NASA is giving the commercial people, and the other thing is, like I say, so NASA doesn't own these assets. So SpaceX tomorrow, or actually whenever they get the thing back from the space station, they can turn around and say, "Hey, we're going to sell rides, orbital rides on this to whoever wants it."
Yeah.
And that is something new.
Yeah.
Which I'm kind of excited to see how that turns out.
I was blown away though by that flight. How easy and simple they made that look. Right down to the spacesuits and right down to the. When they started to dock to the actual space station, mm-hmm. the guys had on cargos and khakis, or they had khaki pants and polo shirts, and dress shoes.
Yeah.
And their spacesuits, they didn't need the spacesuits. I don't think.
Oh, yeah.
They're this thin, they look like they purchased those things from Walmart or something.
And
but it just looks so simple.
And they had the cargo capsule, or they have the cargo version of that capsule, I understand, and it has docked autonomously multiple times.
And that's a competitor to our Antares vehicle here.
Yeah.
So they kind of do the same thing. So it's already had the experience of docking, and I think those guys were just along for the ride. I was a little concerned about, they were, did you hear them when they're describing the sort of the rigorousness of the flight? The vibration
was,
environment.
Is I was surprised at that.
I was surprised at that too. Yeah.
I know that the space shuttle from, you know, when I worked at ATK, you couldn't swing a dead cat without hitting an astronaut, a retired astronaut around there.
Yeah.
They seemed to all come back there.
Yeah.
And they talked and they were like, man, the ride up on the shuttle is ridiculous.
The boosters especially.
Yeah.
And they acknowledged that. They said that the shuttle is in the first stage burn. Is much more extreme from a vibration environment. But then they were talking about the second stage. From the second stage on up to orbit is where they said they were saying the dragon behaved like a dragon.
Yeah.
It was riding a dragon all the way into orbit. And I thought that was odd.
Because what caused that. It looked really smooth.
It did.
And
of course, you can't really tell what's going on inside the cockpit.
And I imagined that it would be smooth, certainly much more so than the shuttle. But, I mean, the shuttle had all kinds of ugly aerodynamics, pushing through the atmosphere anyway.
Yeah.
But,
of course, they're pretty far up in the atmosphere at that point. I think they're pretty much, it would be the three engines for the shuttle versus these, what do they call these engines?
Merlin? The Merlin.
The Merlin engines. So it looked like it was a pretty rough ride. I just wonder if they tested that at all during the first test. I think they flew the capsule, the man-rated capsule.
Yeah.
And tested the environment in there. I wonder if they picked up any strange vibrations, or if they didn't censor it right. And
I don't know. And and how do you say what is and what isn't?
Right.
You know, I don't know what you compare it to. I mean, the Soyuz or whatever.
That'd be a good example. Yeah.
But
those guys both have flown on Soyuz, and they have flown in the space shuttle. Both those astronauts have that experience on both, and they made it sound. If those guys they were talking pretty. They're pretty serious about how bad it was shaking. They did a good job at not throwing it under the bus and making SpaceX look bad, but you could tell there's a major concern there from both of them, highly seasoned astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed a little rattled by that.
Well, I mean, it's a very light vehicle.
Yeah, it could be that could be a big part of it, just the sheer weight of it.
And maybe the aerodynamics of it. Well, I don't think the capsule's any larger in diameter than the rest of the rocket, so.
It's pretty, pretty streamlined from that point of view. And plus, where they were talking about, you're pretty much exo-atmospheric.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think the weight would be a big factor there.
Mm-hmm.
And any kind of combustion oscillations in the engines.
You
are in line with the engines here, whereas in the shuttle they are too, I think, though. You have the big tank underneath, but they're pretty much still in line with those.
Yeah.
So that's always an issue.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, you can get little variations and those oscillations self-replicate in the, you know, as you're shaking the fuel back and forth in the liquid tanks.
Whatever it was, there's some oscillations going on for sure, because they seem pretty concerned about it. They did a good job at not exaggerating too much, but you could tell there was a serious concern. I picked that up anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know if you did.
Well, I don't think I picked up the same thing you did, but I remember them saying something about it being a pretty intense ride, and I was like, I would have figured that with the ability to throttle the engines and everything, they'd have been able to kind of make that smooth. Because that's one thing, you light the space shuttle and it goes, there's not the boosters, a whole lot not of throttling.
Nope. Zero throttling for the first 120 seconds, that's what that burns for.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's another, see, this is another interesting thing, like 2 days before launch, I started to see stuff on Twitter and whatnot. I was like, I thought this would be a huge deal in the news for like months, but it was kind of like it snuck up out of the blue. And I believe that later this year, there's another flight by Boeing or maybe JetBlue or not JetBlue.
Blue Origin.
Yeah, those guys. Maybe Blue Origin, but there's another crew flight.
A crew flight, okay.
With a different commercial.
It must be Blue Origin, I would think, right?
Yeah, that's the Amazon one.
Yeah.
Or Jeff Bezos's.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, but I mean, like, so there's going to be two competitors for that.
It's good for NASA.
Contracts. It's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
It's good for NASA. I think it's good for the aerospace industry and
space. And to allow that flexibility in design as well, and I think that's gonna help out quite a bit as we go to the moon and beyond that.
Yeah.
For sure. I don't think we're gonna do it with just a government owned vehicle.
Well, and then certainly if it's a government owned vehicle, I don't think they'll be able to do it for cheap. Like right. I think this is
it opens up a lot of different options.
Yeah, I think
worldwide, really.
Yeah. And it's gonna drive the cost of space exploration down incredibly, which I think is good because I think more exploration is good.
The coverage, though, I had a different impression there. I saw people all over the world tuning in, and also
yeah, but it was like a week before.
A week before, right? Right.
Yeah, but like I mean, this especially here in the States, like this should have, in my opinion,
been talked about months up to the to the launch.
Oh, by the way, we're going
it wasn't
back
even a full
to,
week. I don't think.
Yeah.
I think it was a full week because they slipped a launch. Right, the first launch slipped, and I think it was only a couple of days when people started to get really serious about it. And but like, it did hit pretty big all over the world.
And like for being in the industry, working for a NASA contract, not really hearing about this, like
there's two competing news stories going on at that time. There was the riots that were going on, and also the COVID thing, of course, was in the news, but not so much. It was mainly the riots that happened the week before, and that was consuming a lot of the news coverage.
Yeah, but anyway, I worked for ATK on whatever the motor was for STS-131, the last shuttle flight. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember when it was like, okay, we're casting the last shuttle motor, and then they were working on follow-on contracts, the heavy lift vehicle and whatnot. Yeah. But it was like, wow, this is the end of an era, and. Yeah. We don't have a way to get back there.
Right. No. Not in America. So this was a huge, huge, huge thing. You're right. And it should have been publicized, I agree, a lot more. That's the biggest thing in aerospace that's happened in the last 10 years in America, I would say. Since the shuttle, what did the shuttle stop flying?
2011
or something. So 9 years it's been. So this is the biggest thing that happened. And honestly, I think the biggest thing before this was when Elon Musk landed the two boosters at the same time.
That was the most impressive thing I have seen in my life.
Yeah, me too. Like, me too. And that doesn't get a lot of coverage either. A lot of people didn't see that.
And I tried to get my wife to watch that, and kids.
I posted it on my Facebook page.
And they were like, oh, wow, that's neat. I'm like,
I got 4 likes.
Yeah. I was my wife was like, oh, that's neat. I'm like, no, that's not neat. That is amazing. Mm-hmm. Having an understanding of what goes into making that happen, that kind of coordination, and just the returning back to
the amount of energy that's being exchanged as well.
Oh,
the orbital velocity and then coming back, reversing direction.
Yeah,
with
like,
a really, really heavy vehicle.
It was incredible and one of the most fascinating.
And even landing a tower. How do you land a tower vertically? That's 100 and some feet tall.
Oh yeah,
and 3 feet in diameter or something like that. It's naturally unstable. It wants to tip over, and he stuck both of them simultaneously, and they stood there like a rock. As the dust plume rose up around him.
Yeah.
It was just amazing.
Yeah, it was and I mean.
It gave me goosebumps just watching that.
And now they're landing them on the barge out there.
Yeah, they actually landed the booster from this flight, the last flight, the manned space flight. They stuck that one on the barge.
Yeah.
They didn't show a whole lot of coverage of it, but there was a shot of it being, what was the barge's name?
Of course I still love you. And then they've got the other one where they're still trying to catch the fairings for the. I don't know, whatever other...
Is it interstage or something?
Yeah, well, I think it's for their cargo vehicle.
Yeah,
it's got some...
They have those ejectable fairings or something. They're trying to recapture in the ocean or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With their giant net.
Yeah.
I don't think they've successfully caught one yet, but I'm like, man, at least somebody...
Somebody's trying.
That's something that I like about that about SpaceX. And so, I mean, I remember working for ATK back in 2010, and we were doing some, SpaceX beat us for a resupply proposal, and I was like, man, this is...
This was ATK having... Who were they working with? What vehicle would that be?
Planetarians? No, it was a new design that they were working on. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what it was, but we were working...
This was before Orbital merged with ATK.
Yeah.
This was ATK...
ATK
Thiokol. Yeah.
And, well, it was ATK Launch Systems,
post-Thiokol.
They changed their name.
Sure. Before the merger, though.
Yeah. And it was, I think it was, I mean, I don't know everything about the business, but to me, it seemed like ATK thought they were the only game in town, and they had been the only game in town for so long that they couldn't figure out how to compete. And so SpaceX came, and I want to say that their bid was like less than half of what our bid was for whatever cargo resupply for the space station was. And they beat us out. And I think a lot of people at ATK were surprised. And they're like, how can this, you know, this little startup company come and think that they're going to do this? And they're willing to take risks, I think, that
major risks
that the industry was not willing to take.
Yeah.
And, you know, SpaceX does it kind of with flair, but
yeah.
I think it's good. And I think it's making, I think it's making the rest of the contractors in the industry be like, okay, we got to get back to the risk taking environment that NASA had in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, right. We took plenty of players back then with those programs as well, the Apollo program.
And, you know,
we got away from that. We got away from that after the failures of the Challenger and some of the accidents that have happened.
We got very, very risk averse. And I think SpaceX is in a position where they're less risk averse, but they haven't killed anybody.
Remember, their first vehicles were just commercial vehicles, supply vehicles, unmanned vehicles. So it allowed them to cut maybe some of those corners.
Well, it allowed them to cut some of the corners. And then I think Elon was self-insuring the payloads.
Right.
So he was saying, you know, if we, you know, he's like, there's a 50-50 chance we're going to blow up your payload on the on the launch pad, and I'll pay for it. And people were like, okay.
Yeah.
And so they were able to get cheap flights and do a lot of tests, and they blew up a fair amount of rockets on the pad.
I think he's a large factor in terms of this new risk-taking culture. He loves the challenges. He's motivated by that. That's what keeps him running. That's what keeps him up. Wakes him up in the morning, and that's what he thinks about all day long.
Yeah,
and it fuels him, this type of risk.
From what I understand, he's very much driven towards certain, you know, goal-driven. And I remember I was watching an interview with him once, and he was talking about, you know, the startup of SpaceX and Tesla and this stuff. And he said, so I had just, you know, I just sold PayPal for $1 billion. And I decided I'm going to take half of it, and I'll start this space company, which I always wanted to do. And if it fails, I'm willing to lose.
He's not afraid to fail.
Yeah, and so I mean, like,
that's his biggest asset, I think, in this industry.
Yeah, he was willing to risk $500 million. That takes some.
It does. It does.
Some guts, and I don't think we see that in the industry. And $500 million of his own dollars.
Right.
You know, so. So good on him. I think he's doing good things.
Yeah.
And I think the industry is going to benefit from it. But
you got to be a risk taker in a business when you're in the rocket business. It's always going to be a risky challenge whenever you push the envelope as far as you can. If you're going to go to the moon, if you're going to go to Mars, you're going to have risk. And the more you try to fight that fact, I think the more difficult you're going to make it for yourself. Now, you don't want to cut so many corners where you're going to have one in two chance of dying or anything like that. But I think that you're going to have risk, and there's going to be a pretty high risk that you just got to accept. And the astronauts will all accept that if there's any astronauts. Even the astronauts that were going up on this last flight, they gave them a 1 in 240 chance, was it, something like that?
Complete
rocket failure. Like, yeah, that's cool. We'll take that. We'll take that risk. No problem.
Yeah.
So the astronauts, the people piloting the vehicles, are risk takers as well.
Yeah, so it's at a 0.2% chance.
The shuttle is probably much higher, I would imagine, with all the components on that thing. I don't know what the numbers are for that.
I don't remember either, but
they exist for sure.
Yeah,
somebody's thinking somebody, this up.
There's somebody out there who knows exactly what the
flight safety guy.
Well, what the risk is.
Yeah,
but yeah. But yeah. So I mean, I guess what do you think would be do you see this as an improvement in our industry?
Big time,
to commercialization?
I think so. And you can tell from looking at the differences between the Apollo and the space shuttle, and then this cockpit here and the Dragon vehicle.
You think there's going to be?
I think it's a cultural improvement too. It's just it's now this cultural trend that Elon Musk has said has sort of made it cool again to be in the rocket propulsion field or in the rocket vehicle field. You know, the NASA, the SpaceX's, the ATKs, the Northrop Grumman's. I think it's now cool again. And when I fly around the world to go, you know, when I go see my wife in Europe, I'm in the airports and I see teenagers wearing NASA shirts. And everybody wants, all the teenagers there want me to, in the Czech Republic, want me to bring them NASA shirts. They're all wearing them now. Even here, you see kids. It's cool now. NASA's cool again.
Yeah.
And I think Elon Musk has a lot to do with that. I think that mentality that he has to take all these risks, to cut these, not just Elon, but NASA itself, and just all of the progress made by even Northrop Grumman and some of the stuff we do here.
There's a lot. I've noticed that, like Tony Stark, he's making engineers look sexy, no longer
in
are
films,
in movies and stuff. So like, no longer is it tape wrapped around your horn rimmed glasses, sharpening your pencil.
When I was going through college, it was very much that.
Yeah,
it was very much that. If you were in engineering, you were a dork, basically, and you had your pocket protector and your TI-82, and that pretty much defined your whole character.
Yeah, and now you got Tony Stark, you got Elon Musk, you got these other these figures that are being. Where engineering is being portrayed more.
Yeah, and it's also that it starts at elementary school too. Now there's a huge, but in the last 5 years I've been working with the outreach programs here at NASA. There's a huge push in STEM, so at all the schools now, so science, technology, and math, engineering, math activities. That's really big in schools now. And the first thing that STEM leads to is something as challenging as something as a space program, I think. So that's been a big factor too. There was no STEM. When you and I were going through school. I was born in 79, you were 78 or...
81.
Oh, you're younger than this, right? Yeah, so we didn't have that stuff going through school. I don't know about you, but we were pretty much the outcasts if you were going into engineering of any kind.
Yeah, I don't remember being an outcast, but I remember being, like, you liked math and science, so you were that kind of nerd.
Right.
It certainly wasn't cool. The cool kids weren't... going to do engineering.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah.
They got made fun of quite a bit for that.
Yeah. And
like, but it was all good fun. It wasn't like I was rejected from a crowd or anything.
You were talking about outreach and it reminded me. So you know about the first robotics league?
Yeah.
The Lego leagues and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to or I was working with a high school in Sierra Vista.
In Arizona.
Mm-hmm. And one of the kids who had been on the team and graduated and went to college, he came back, and he had gone to work for headquarters of the First Robotics League or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the head guy there, I can't remember his name, he was talking to the kids, and he was saying, in that First Robotics League, he was trying to make, STEM a competitive type of, a game, make it competitive, make it like a team sport kind of thing. And he said, all these kids who come here and participate in this league and do this differ from, kids who get into football or baseball or whatever, he says, because every one of these kids can go pro.
Right.
In engineering.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a pretty good, way to look at it.
I had that fantasy of being a professional basketball player.
Yeah.
When I was going through school. So I was one of those kids.
Yeah.
I had that in the back of my mind and wasted a lot of time and energy, I think, doing that. It was good fitness stuff and working out and all that stuff. But I was really heartbroken when I learned one day that I wasn't going to play in the NBA.
Yeah.
So now I got my backboard in the pool, and that's my professional career.
Yep. Yeah. So.
But that was a hard realization back then. That was the cool thing back then. You played professional sports.
I'd do it if I could, but
But that was what was accepted as cool, right? You play college athletics, you're the man. Now, if you go to work for NASA, you're some geek off in the corner.
Well, I mean, I remember in high school. So I did sports in high school, but I had no disillusions that. I was gonna be anything. I knew I wasn't gonna get a scholarship and go to college. Yeah. I wasn't gonna make pro.
Other than that, by about ninth grade.
Yeah.
But up till ninth grade, I was disillusioned.
But even then, my high school coach. I think we had a meet or something one weekend, but my family was going to Disneyland or something, and I was like, "Yeah, coach, sorry, I'm not gonna make it to this meet." And he's like, "Well, what's going on?" I'm like, "Well, my family's going on a trip. We're going out of town. I'm going to be with them." And he's like, "Look, man, you got to get your priorities straight." I was like,
"That's a little backwards."
I was like, "Okay, sure. Whatever, coach."
There are still a lot of coaches like that.
And they
really believe that. That's the number one priority. That's what should be for every kid.
Yeah. And in high school, if you're spending all that time doing sports, So I did, you know, I threw in high school and on the track team, mm-hmm. and one of the guys I threw with ended up playing in the NFL. So mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. I mean, it happens.
It happens, yeah. Right, right.
He was a monster in high school and yeah. like.
Just naturally athletic.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. And did well.
Exist. It happens.
He did well in the pros, and I.
If you make it to the pros, you're doing well no matter what.
Yeah. But yeah, so, yeah.
It's consuming, yeah. though. It takes a lot. High school, when I was going through high school, I don't know what it's like now. I have no idea what sports were our entire life. Yeah. And a lot of our parents, mine weren't like this so much, but a lot of the parents reinforced it as well. And pretty much, you know, they were like slave owners of their kids, making sure they play sports.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that mattered.
I know that my parents encouraged us to participate in extracurricular activities, mm-hmm. but there wasn't anything like I was not pushed to perform or right, anything. Right. It was, and I mean,
this is Arizona where you grew up. Okay.
And I did wrestling, and my mom didn't like it because she didn't enjoy the sport.
Right.
And right. you know, and yeah. so it was what it was. But
yeah. I come from a place in Michigan. It's a pretty rough place. We're the types of teams with the dads in the audience that will fight the referees and the umpires. Oh, yeah. There, several of them at the same time. It's a rowdy, rowdy environment.
Oh, my sister's basketball team in high school. They had I don't even think that there was a guy. He would come and make himself known in the crowd. But
there's always at least one.
I don't think he had any.
Does this still happen today?
Oh yeah.
Is it okay? I haven't been in a high school like competitive sport.
Yeah.
Or sat and watched a basketball game in years.
I think it happens, but like
everybody's being so sensitive nowadays. I wouldn't be surprised if they went away.
I don't even know if they have competitive sports that much anymore. Like if it's all participation trophies and whatnot.
I know they don't down here, and I know in Michigan they still do. I don't know in other states. California they had quite a bit of it, but
I'm sure they do. They still got to have competition somewhere.
They do. And in certain sports, like basketball is big around here. But you don't really hear much about football ever.
And yeah.
So it's a little different, I think, depending on where you're at in the country.
Well, I think if you go down to Texas, you'll hear about Oklahoma, high school Texas. Football.
Sure, sure. That's never going to fade.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But, that was another thing I wanted to talk to you about. So you're a fitness, I would say, enthusiast.
Yeah, right? Yeah, fitness enthusiast.
Well, and a fitness entrepreneur. You got your business with
Versus Spot. I've been doing that now for a few years. Yeah.
How difficult was it to get into that?
It took me a long time to actually get to the point where we're making money, for sure. Yeah. We had several different ideas that came out at first. This all started back in 2008, actually, when I was living out in California,
mm-hmm.
In San Clemente and Newport Beach. I actually built my first unit out of wood. My buddy and I, he's an engineer as well. And we always went to the gym and were like, man, we could do so much more weight with dumbbells. If you could just get the dumbbells up in the starting position
mm-hmm.
as you start with a bench press where, you know, the dumbbells are over your chest. Yeah. Instead of picking them off the ground, yanking them up,
put them on your knees,
kicking them back. Them you exert a lot of energy. And actually, the energy is equal to about 3 or 4 reps is what it works out to.
No, sure.
So it's a lot of different, you get a major strength advantage, but there's nothing that existed in the market.
And to lift those up, it's incredibly dangerous. And
yeah, and drop them on the floor as well.
Risky because you're doing it at like weird angles.
Exactly. Yeah.
Pulling funny ways, you got
risk
of ligament damage every time.
Yes, you
try to pull up
shoulder ligaments. Yeah, it happens all the time. Guys get hurt all the time, and especially with a decline bench press. I don't know if you have decline.
Yeah.
You ever try to climb into a decline press with dumbbells?
Oh yeah.
And you're the funny thing is, decline is your strongest movement, so you get the most weight.
Yeah.
But in the conventional setting, you got to climb into that bench. And then you have to lean back when I'm doing 120-pound dumbbells with 240 pounds and slam back. Hopefully the bench catches you. You don't drop them. And then you can start your movement. It's just a pain in the ass to initiate the workout.
Yeah.
So we thought, why not design a fixture that you can put the dumbbells above your head? It doesn't exist. No one had it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We saw a couple old models.
I've never seen one until you showed me your thing. So
it was completely innovative. And we thought, oh, my God, we got to get a patent. That's the first thing we got to do. Because we heard, you know, you invent something, you got to get a patent. And we learned a lot of lessons there. Patents are really expensive. We spent $25,000 on our first patent.
Yeah.
And it was a standalone device that we built. It's kind of like the one you use today out there. Mm-hmm. That's a different prototype that we had. But it was a standalone unit. So you pull a bench up to it, park it there, and we're still recording?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. you park the bench underneath of it, and you have arms that rotate up. It's like the one at NASA Wallops. Mm-hmm. And you can do a decline press, a flat press, a decline press, or a shoulder press, mm-hmm. depending on the angle of the arm that you set. The problem with that was it was $1,500 and 250 pounds.
Yeah.
So shipping was enormous, and it was just really difficult to manufacture. And then we had to fly out to the location to put this thing together because we didn't want – there's pretty precise moving parts on there mm-hmm. If you look at it closely. Too precise to have the customer put it, or put the consumer put it together. We were worried about the risk.
You'd really only be putting it in gyms and
commercial gyms. That was our target. Commercial gyms. Mm-hmm. Turns out the commercial gyms don't have as much money as you think. These aren't big revenue generating, monsters. The gyms are pretty tight actually. A lot of their money, and so we had a device that was $1,500.
Because I mean, if you're gonna start a gym, you're gonna easily spend $250,000
in equipment, just
to open the door.
Right, exactly. So they're not overly cash-strapped as it was. And so we had this device. We tried marketing to some of them. They didn't like the fact that it took up some extra footprint on the gym. They didn't really see a whole lot of purpose in it. But in the meantime, we were going to trade shows. That would cost a lot of money there, a few grand every time you go to a trade show.
Yeah.
You got to fly out there. You got to move all the equipment. You got to rent the floor space. You got to buy electricity. They charge you nickel and dime you for everything you can imagine.
I'm sure.
And on top of all this, the patent was $25,000. And one of the lessons we learned there is if you're going to patent something, you need to make sure that you have a viable product that people are going to buy. And mm-hmm. sometimes you think, oh, my God, I got this great idea. I got to patent it right now. It's the first thing I got to do because we heard somebody's going to steal the idea. Well, nobody's going to take the idea. And if you have it documented really well, you're already the first. You have the rights to the design.
Yeah.
So no one can ever cut you out of the loop and mm-hmm. say, oh, you can't build it anymore. But what we did is spent $25,000 on a product we haven't even tried marketing yet because we were so sure that it was going to be a huge success. Mm. And we did sell, we sold 10 to 15 of them. Mm. We actually sold like 5 of them to some oil sheik in the Middle East. He ordered them and rare falcons is what he put them on the boat with. This was in the country of Qatar, over there in the Middle East. And so that was our first sale. But we had to fly out back to Michigan, put them all together, get them on crates, wood crates, because they're 250 pounds.
Yeah.
And it was about... He paid the shipping. It was about $4,000 shipping to New York Harbor, where mm-hmm. he had his boat sitting, and then they took him from New York Harbor overseas.
Did you have to put them together out there in Qatar?
No, we didn't. We pre-assembled them all and put them in crates that were 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet.
But the big freight on that was
huge, yeah, and it was just impractical for worldwide sales. We shouldn't have been thinking about that. But even for domestic sales, we're having a hard time justifying. Nobody saw this piece of equipment before. You're trying to sell them $1,500, $2,000 piece of equipment, it wasn't moving too smooth. So we shifted gears then. Then that's what we came out with, this new unit that we have here.
We thought streamlined.
We thought, what's the cheap? People, they don't want to buy this. First of all, there's not a whole lot of gyms in the country when you look at it to do business mm-hmm. with. Commercial gyms, there's 30,000 gyms maybe, something like that. But that's really not a whole lot considering they're not all going to buy it, first of all. So we looked at what's the biggest market out there. And what's the cheapest we can build this thing for? What's the absolute lowest we can sell this thing for? And what we were interested in at first, and we're still kind of in this phase, is we wanted to try to make the lowest possible cost. We'll even, if we break even, that's okay. Because what our model is we want to break even as much as we can. No, don't lose money, mm-hmm. but break even, maybe make a little bit of money, which is what we're doing now. But we wanted to get the volume up, our manufacturing volume up high enough. So when we're making 10 units at a time, say it's $200 a unit, when we're making 100 units at a time, it's $100 a unit. If I can do 1,000 units at a time, we can drive the cost down to $50 a unit. And that's sort of our model. Let's just flood the market, get as much out there, get our name well-known, which we have a name now. People know us in fitness. We're on Facebook. We pop up all over the place now.
Oh, good.
And so we have a name. Yeah, it's going pretty well. People know who we are. And that's what our first step was. And now once people know who we are, we're getting massive amounts of orders. And we're increasing the volume of what we're manufacturing. And that's driving down the cost, and that's increasing the value of our business, and mm-hmm. it's going to increase the profit margin as well. But right now, we're basing our whole company on really the net sales that we have every year, mm-hmm. and so we're doing pretty good. We're selling about $150,000 a year in terms of net sales now, and there's not a whole lot of profit in that.
Yeah.
But you look at the value of the business, and it's twice your sales. So really, the value of our business right now is about $300,000, which we're growing still, but we're pretty proud of that fact. That we're still growing and expanding there. But we have a cheap product now, and we bolt into an existing squat rack with 1-inch holes or with 5/8 holes are the typical sizes. We're available on Rogue Fitness now. We're selling about $100 a month to Rogue, and it's moving really well.
Yeah, if you can get that to be like an add-on to a power rack where somebody's buying the power rack and then you can just add this on for another $150.
Exactly. And I don't know if you've paying attention at all, but the home gym market now, everybody, the cool thing to do now, it's just like you were using my gym today, is I have a home gym, especially with this COVID thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
So people are going crazy right now with home gyms. That's all they want. They realize that the gyms are closing down and it's only going to get worse in the future. And people are also realizing for what they're spending a year in a gym membership, they can invest that same annual amount of money and have a rack, a barbell set up to 400 pounds, and a dumbbell set. And it's not everything the gym has, but it's pretty much everything you need to maintain a good physique.
Yes.
And the comfort of your own home with your shower, you know, a second, you know, 5 second walk from your gym.
Yeah.
And all the time you don't realize driving to the gym, preparing for the gym, showering after the gym, that's 45 minutes right there, plus your hour-long workout.
Yeah.
So you shave off those 45-minute workout, the 45 minutes.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who like to go to the gym just to be at the gym, though.
There are, yeah. And I was one of those when I was 20 years old. I like to go to the gym, look at the girls. I was in that boat for sure, the mentality there to lift with guys and have that, you know, camaraderie and that extra push that helps sometimes. And some people suffer in home gym environments. They don't do too well.
Yeah.
They don't have the discipline, the follow-through to do it. So there is that, too, but it is a huge market for us now, and Rogue Fitness is the leader in that market, so that's what we partnered with, and it's been working really, really well for us, and I only see it getting better with this whole COVID and, you know, this whole hysteria over this flu that we're going through.
But it's been quite a learning experience, I guess, as an entrepreneur or a businessman.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah, it's been 12 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah, we failed quite a bit. We've had products that just didn't move. We over-designed things, didn't think things through, even with the current unit that we have, there are areas where we can improve. We have a lot of customer feedback. Mm-hmm. Our shipping costs are from our organic sales, the ones we get from our website, which constitute probably about 10 to 15% of our sales. The rest is Rogue. Yeah. Those are costing us an arm and a leg to ship. So we don't have the deals that Rogue has with the shipping, you know, people. So we pay seven. If I want to ship something to California, we have to charge $70 for shipping. That's about $70. So it's 30 pounds, the equipment. So I massively over-designed it. But I wanted to have that stability. I thought that was more important. But that's something to consider when you start a business is how much can you ship these things for? Because you're going to be shipping all over the country and all over the world.
Yeah, and if the cost of shipping is equal to the cost of the product, that's immediately going to turn a lot of people
off. It turns a lot of people off, yeah. So what we do is offer a flat rate, and we increase the price of the product to cover some of that on average with the flat rate would be. Flat rates are 30 and 50. You don't want to charge somebody. Nobody's going to feel good paying $75 for shipping. Yeah. So we build that into the cost of the product. So, you know, slightly we'll increase the cost of the product by $30 to cover some of these long ranges. And Hawaii, the ship to Hawaii was $250.
Oh, yeah.
So we really stick to the Continental 48 for organic sales. Rogue can do cheap. Rogue can ship to Europe. They have Rogue Europe over there. So they have all these shipping channels and deals with shipping companies because they're moving so much weight.
If you ship it to Hawaii, does it have to go air freight or can you put it on a boat?
No, it's air freight. It's all air freight. Yep. Same thing even with Nova Scotia. We had a couple out there. We've had sales in Canada. And the interesting thing was in Germany, we did a sale to a U.S. military base. I think it was Ramstein. Mm-hmm. And it was $50. Cheaper than anywhere in the United States because it was a U.S. address.
Oh, yeah.
So they must do some kind of kickback there.
Yeah, I think if you're shipping to an air base, you can get on like the, you know, they have cargo planes that.
That's probably what it was.
Yeah. That make what they call like the milk run. I think their Air Force has like a standard patrol route that's like. I want to say it's like Okinawa, Japan, Guam, Hawaii,
all the military hubs.
Then it hits like, you know, it hits the continental United States and it goes over to England, Germany, down to Middle East, and then back over to Japan. And so they just have a constant patrol going. And
yeah, it was cheap. That's really cheap. I was surprised. Wow, going to Germany. It's the furthest we've ever shipped, I think. And it was cheaper than anywhere in the United States almost.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of learning experiences. We get a lot of feedback from customers that we try our best to implement, you know, just little things. We're really good with customer service. If there's any kind of damage at all during the shipment, we just ship the customer a new unit. We get a lot of positive feedback from our customers. They feel treated very well with that. When they unpack the piece of equipment, they feel like their $220 investment is something that is a good investment because they know it's not going to break. It's going to last them forever. And we're proud of that. Even though we're not making much money off of it, we're breaking even, basically. We have a lot of happy customers out there who are really getting a lot of great use out of this. We get tremendous feedback from all over the world, really, in terms of people's satisfaction and how much they're able, how much more they're able to lift, really, and how comfortable they feel with the unit itself. It's rock solid, and we're very proud of that fact. We like to maintain that, mm-hmm. and that's why we're keeping our manufacturing here in America. We don't want to go overseas and get lower quality metals and have units start breaking on people.
Yeah.
It causes a lot of damage when you have a couple hundred pounds of dumbbells over your head.
So yeah, we don't tear somebody's shoulder out by...
Yeah, it could happen. Yeah, tear somebody's shoulder out, a dumbbell could land on their forehead if it was a cup was to break off from a bad weld or some weak materials.
Yeah.
So we want to keep the structural integrity high and the quality high.
Liability you don't need.
Yeah, we do have liability insurance as well. I haven't had to use it yet, not a single incident. Out of, I think we have about a couple thousand units out there now. So no major issues, that knock on wood.
So you got into the fitness equipment basically to solve a problem that you had for your own.
Yeah, for my own use. Yeah, I just thought, I've always been pretty good at dumbbells. I was always kind of in the top 10 to 20% of the people in the gym from dumbbell weight. I've always been really good, strong at dumbbell movements for some reason. Maybe it's the stabilizer muscles or something. Mm-hmm. I have good stabilizer muscles. But I just realized that I could do a lot, hell of a lot better if I could, have a different starting platform. And having an engineering mind, you know, being in the rocket propulsion field my whole life, I'm constantly thinking of ways, how can I make this a little bit better? That's kind of how we do with solid rocket motors. You know, there's not a whole lot of room for drastic improvement.
Yeah.
But there are little 1% improvement, 2% improvements. That's kind of what we're always digging after. And it's sort of the same thing. I have that mindset, I guess, going after work or while I'm during work. I take that mindset into the gym and just kind of maybe just automatically derive these things or come up with these ideas to make things just a little bit better, make them a little bit easier so you can use more of energy to attain what you're after.
Yeah.
Which for me was a physique, right? I'm mm-hmm. trying to lift as much weight, develop as much muscle as I can. And I don't want to waste it doing deadlifts when I'm focusing on an isolation move for the chest.
Yeah. So are you trying to get, I guess, the most strength, or are you trying to, like, are you just trying to maintain at this point a physique and a fitness?
No, I've maintained for many years.
You're still trying to get stronger?
Stronger right now, yeah, and I am actually improving quite a bit. From 30-year-old to maybe 36-year-old, 37 mm-hmm. years old, I was in a maintenance mode. I wasn't very motivated. I was going through a lot of depression mm-hmm. In life, basically, and had some hard times with my son and that whole situation mm-hmm. Surrounding that, and just with the whole custody and all that stuff. It really caused major depression, and that really shut me down in terms of my weightlifting hobby and things like that. I kind of just was happy maintaining. I wasn't very driven. I was just kind of happy getting by, getting through the day, you know, just scraping by.
Did the fitness help, or did the – do you think that lifting helped with depression and stuff?
It did. Yeah, it helped a lot. But in terms of my overall drive compared to where I'm at now, mm-hmm. I don't have those same stressors. I've overcome a lot of that stuff and I eliminate those challenges. And now I'm a lot more driven. So I'm back to gaining strength and trying to get – I'm actually stronger than I've ever been in my entire life right now.
You're going to try to get to, like, strongman levels?
No, nothing like that. Nothing like that. But I just compete against myself. And I have goals in mind. I want to bench 405 pounds. Mm-hmm. I like to deadlift over 500 and maybe squat about 500 as well. So those are powerlifting goals, really.
Yeah.
But I want to do it while maintaining a good body fat percentage as well.
Yeah.
I like to be more on the bodybuilding side of things mm-hmm. in terms of body fat levels and things like that. But I do have those. Those are kind of my upper limits in terms of driving what I'm after in the gym. Are those limits that sort of that, you know, I guess it would be a 1,400 pound big three when you combine yeah. the deadlift, the squat, and the bench press.
Yeah.
I want to be around 1,400. Right now I'm about 1,200. And I started a couple of years ago at about 1,000.
Over 1,000 is not bad.
Yeah, 1,000 is the gold standard. Yeah. So I broke that a couple of years ago and steadily been climbing. But it's hard. I mean, I only gained maybe 20 pounds total mm-hmm. in the big three over a period of a few months.
Yeah, but so you're going to have to put on some mass to do that. I mean, that's why I've been trying.
Yeah, so I lost my six-pack, all that stuff. And I'm still at a pretty lean level. But I have been eating six meals a day,
yeah.
4,000 or 5,000 calories. I've always had a hard time gaining weight. That's always been a challenge for me. But to do that, like you say, you see all the big guys, you know, the Hawthorns and the Brian Shaws and all these guys, Eddie Hall. They're all big, heavy guys.
And it makes me wonder, what the physiology behind that is. Like I realize that. To some extent, you have to have more muscle mass to lift more weight.
Right. Yeah.
But
the body
do you have to have 400 pounds of body weight to be able to lift that much.
You know, I think it might increase your bone density when you have that much body weight.
Oh, yeah.
And that might have something to do with the increased strength. But in terms of the physiology of it, yeah, muscle is the mechanism, the engine driving the weight back and forth, right? So you would think more muscle you have, that's the only thing that's going to help. But it seems like the heavier you are, when you pick that weight up, if you weigh as much as that weight, or the more you weigh, the more weight you can move. It just seems to be a fact of life.
Yeah.
Heavier you are, the more weight you move. Maybe it's because you're lifting your own body weight all day long.
Yeah.
It could be psychological. I don't know, but yeah, I've always wondered that too, what the physiology is behind it. But I know the human body is only capable. We watched that video that I sent you. What was it called? Born Strong with Eddie Hall and the scientist talking.
Yeah.
He's like, the body can only pack on so much muscle. At some point, if you want to gain weight, you have to start putting on fat.
Yeah.
And so that's what these guys do. They're just constantly eating. Now, they're not eating shit all day long. They're eating good food.
And it's like, do they need to actually have a fat to create mass so that they can move it? Or is the fat just giving them what they need to build the muscle? Like, will your body not allow you to build more muscle? Is that what he's saying? And to, once you get that big, like...
Yeah, you can only pack... The bone can only hang so much muscle from it before it has to... Before it can't support anymore. I mean, the skeleton can't support any more muscles. There's a limit there.
Yeah.
So the only other way you can gain mass is by adding fat. Now, it's just that everybody seems to agree the more mass you have, the more mass you move. And I don't understand...
I don't understand it because...
It's confusing.
So I'm...
But all the guys, you look at all the guys, they're... All built the same.
Yeah, but I'm over 300 pounds, and I'm not moving anywhere near as much weight as you're moving. So, I mean...
Right, right. There is a percentage, I think, right, of muscle to fat.
Yeah.
You want to try to maintain.
I mean, Brian Shaw's, he competes at, what, 450?
425? Yeah, he's up there, like over 4. Brian Shaw, those guys, Eddie Hall and Hawthor are all over 4.
Yeah, Hawthor, he seems to have a little bit... He looks a little bit leaner.
They always talk about how he has actually abs. And Arnold Schwarzenegger even commented, he looks like a bodybuilder in the off season, who's the hottest season, who's just, you know, he hasn't cut up yet, he hasn't shredded, but he's packed on all this mass.
Yeah.
He's close to a bodybuilder, but he's 6'9" as well. So I think that helps spread out that weight. Those other guys, well, Brian Shaw's 6'8", and Eddie Hall is 6'5" only. So he's a short guy.
He's the little
So he's going to show the fat the most. If they're all 400 pounds,
he's
going to look the fattest, for sure.
Yeah, but I mean... Of that 400 pounds, you know, there's got to be like 280 of it.
280 is probably solid muscle. Sure. I would think
that's just pure muscle mass.
And I bet you that the percentages are relatively similar.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because there's bone weight, too, and Hawthorne's obviously going to have the most bone weight.
Because
it's so tall.
You got bone weight. You got bone mass. You got organ tissue and whatnot. But still, I mean, there's at least two people's worth of actual muscle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sure, in each one of those guys.
Yeah.
But do you think they're all juiced and strong?
Yeah, well, they are. They all admit to it as well. So it's a pretty well-known thing that everybody's juiced up pretty well. You just can't compete in those sports. There are natural leagues for bodybuilding and for powerlifting, but you wouldn't want to go watch them. It wouldn't be fun to watch them.
Yeah.
It's when you got a group of monsters sitting here, and a group of natural athletes. It's super impressive that the natural athletes can do what they do.
Yeah.
But it's just not going to draw the fanfare, the crowds, as a bunch of juiced up monsters. The same thing with the NFL or any professional sport, really. Everybody is. I think that there's a lot more people on gear or steroids than you realize. So
I mean,
it's becoming very, very commonplace.
I think it's. Amusing how much we clutch our pearls when somebody gets caught doing steroids. I think that I would like to see. I mean, I would pay money for a ticket in a league of any sport where it was like open class.
Yeah.
Do what you want. I want to see the strongest, swiftest,
most extreme thing. Right.
Like when we start, you go to a baseball game where, the pitcher's throwing 115, and then some monster gets up there and starts ripping 600 or 700 foot home runs.
Mark
so, I mean that's I like that. I think that I don't know what do you think why do you think there's such a stigma with steroids?
Yeah, they're classified as drugs, right? So anytime you do drugs, I think in our society, it's looked down as a negative thing, and a lot of people think that it's giving them an unfair edge. In competition, everything should be fair. But what they don't realize is that everyone is doing these substances. So in order to keep up, if you want to stay afloat as an athlete, if you don't do them, you're committing career suicide.
Yeah.
In any kind of professional sports in America, anyways.
Well, I mean, if they were to, I guess, legalize it, for lack of a better term, within the leagues.
I think it pretty much unspokenly is legalized.
Well, I mean, they've got...
They test, right? But I think that's...
Yeah, but they know when they're going to test.
They know they're going to test, and you can work around that and drop your levels when you need to.
But, I think the fairness complaint goes away if you're like, well, we're going to legalize it, and we're going to regulate it, and you're going to be able to do, whatever. So, I mean, yeah, I don't understand what the stigma is if it's just... Drugs are bad.
I think it's just drugs are bad. Say no to drugs.
Yeah.
You always hear that growing up. And so they are controlled substances, and I think that falls under that category. And then the unfair advantage as well. And
unfair advantage, but everybody's
going to... Where do you draw the line, right? Taking protein powder, is that an unfair advantage? Or
eating
steak every day? Or
is an extra 3 inches of height an unfair advantage in basketball?
Right. Of course, steroids aren't going to give you any extra height. But,
no, but I mean, maybe the extra jump or
right,
something.
Right, right.
But like, I mean, you can't control fairness.
Right.
You know, yeah. I mean, somebody's got an 8 foot wingspan and he's six foot nine. Like, he's gonna dominate in the paint. Like,
and at the end of the day, to me, sports are entertainment.
Yeah.
It's not that serious.
About the Olympics?
Entertainment as well. There's still sports. There's still games. And to me, if you want to juice up, take steroids, I condone it. I would rather see the most extreme thing a human body can achieve.
Yes, I think though. I think for like professional sports, mm-hmm. I'm with you. But I think in amateur sports, like the Olympic, the Olympics is intended to be an amateur, a gaming arena.
Okay.
We started sending professional players to play baseball and basketball and whatnot, and I don't really like that.
We stopped that now, right? We don't send the dream team over there anymore. The
I don't NBA know. Basketball players. I think we stopped because we got beat, which was like, if you're going to send the dream team
got
American
beat?
Basketball, I thought they did in the last set of Olympics.
Not the one with Jordan Johnson and
No. That one destroyed everybody.
It was. I think it stopped because it was just unfair.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't even exciting to watch.
I think they should send the college basketball national champions.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I think that would be good because then it's an actual team.
Yeah.
It's not like this.
And your thought about steroids on that? You think it would be better? You think it'd be more fair? Because I'm probably.
I don't want to say it's more fair. I mean, they're gonna find their win. I appreciate something in the nostalgia of it just being,
You like tradition. You tend to talk about tradition a lot. You were talking about that with Hawthorne's lift recently in the gym.
Yeah.
Whether it should be recognized as a world champion or as the world class deadlift or not.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
You're talking about that. Oh, at first I was like, I think it's okay, and then I started thinking about what you said. And I started thinking about, how you could kind of flaw the weights. Obviously, Hawthorne didn't do that. He had official people there.
Yeah.
But it's not to stop someone else from...
But there's also something about...
Open that door.
About setting a world record in competition.
Yeah, so like, exactly. There is. You got to travel to the place. You got to change your diet.
There's all of that. But, there's also somebody can challenge you there.
Right.
You know, like, somebody else has the opportunity and... Mm-hmm. You don't get to, in a competition, you don't get to set all the variables.
Right.
So
you
got to show up when it's your time to
That's
make
right.
the lift.
Yep.
You can't be like, all right, we're going to do this in 10 minutes. We're going to do it when I'm ready. No, it's like,
exactly.
It's your turn now. You've got 45 seconds to complete the lift.
Yeah.
If not, you don't win.
Yeah.
And I think there's something to that.
I started thinking about the same type of stuff after you brought that up. Like, hey, you know, you're right. I think keeping the competition, it should not be recognized as a world championship deadlift.
Yeah, and like...
And he should acknowledge that. I really think it'd be a very big thing of him to acknowledge that.
Yeah, and I mean, I get it. He's lifted the most weight, the most verified weight.
It's still not meaningless by any means. But to call it a world championship deadlift,
it's definitely
a world record deadlift, I think that's... I don't think that's quite right.
Yeah, and it pushes the sport forward. It
It brings crowds into the competition to watch that. That's the whole life energy of this thing.
Yeah.
That's why that's cool. You start doing this in home gyms, like you say, there's no variables, and there's really nothing to keep somebody from cheating in there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you have thousands of people doing it,
yeah, and
you're going to get YouTube videos of some dude lifting 1,500 pounds.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I can go in your gym and lift those 170s in the corner.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to tell. Now, I think, I'm not saying Hawthorne did that. He didn't. He had official
people. No, he did.
Sure. But that opens a new door to that. That'll drive the competition completely out of the arena. It won't.
Yeah.
Nobody will want to watch it anymore. It'll get stupid.
Yeah.
Everybody will be banking world records every month.
And, you know, I was listening to somebody who was talking about, especially in the sport of strongman, mm-hmm. whether or not deadlift should be a strongman recognized lift or event or whatever. Like they all do deadlift, mm-hmm. but like
I think deadlift's the most important one,
right?
Historically,
but
if you can't do deadlift, there's no reason to be alive.
Yeah. Who is that? What's his name?
Paul. Some Icelandic.
Yeah. Had a lot of, yeah.
He lifted that wagon wheel. He said that.
But that's the thing. Like, if you're going to do a strongman lift and you're going to set a deadlift, you should lift something, not a barbell.
Oh, okay.
Like, pick up a truck. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a strongman lift. You know, like, there should be some,
Okay, strongman, sure. I'm thinking powerlifting.
Yeah, powerlifting.
Powerlifting needs to be a barbell. Celebrated weights.
And so, like, in the deadlift, that's another thing. So you've got the strongman deadlift, which is a world record. You've got, like, the elephant bar deadlift.
Yeah, right. There's different bars.
There's
different flexibilities. And,
like, the for real, I can't remember, the raw deadlift where you can't have lifting suit or straps or anything.
Belt, straps.
Can't
no
have
strapless.
A bouncy bar. Or,
well, Eddie Hall did 1,000 pounds with no straps. I think I remember seeing something like that.
Yeah, I don't know, but there's like four, I think, different categories.
There are different categories. I'm not very familiar with all of them.
But, you know, I think the strong man deadlift should be like you have to pick up like a thing, like a giant stone or a car.
Or a log.
Or these a house or something, you know, like just because there should be some – so like the – going back to the tradition, mm-hmm. the history of strongman goes back to circus sideshows and things like that. So there should be some spectacle to it.
And maybe in Europe, you talk about the boulder lifting,
you
know, carrying rocks around, that kind of thing.
And
even back to the Viking era, if you watch that one from Rogue, that was the rights to the ship. If you could lift a 50-kilogram stone, you got one-third of the ship. If you could lift if you're half strong and you could lift 100 kilograms, you got half the ship. If you were full strong, you had access to the full ship. That was like a 150-kilogram rock.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty neat in that Rogue video. I sent you that one as well.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to watch that?
Yeah. I can't remember. It was the title of it was Full Strength in Icelandic or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's interesting. I think that it's, you know, what Hathor did, I think it's good for – I think in many ways it's good for the sport because it sparks some interest and conversation, you know, about it. Like, should this be or not?
It doesn't have to be a very, like – demeaning conversation or one that takes away from the sport. It's a great conversation to have. Is it legitimate or not to call that a world record? And I think you're right. I don't think it is legitimate. I think it's still remarkable they did it and it should be noted, but it should not be considered a world record. World record should be only done in competition.
Yeah.
And a lot of people agree with that as well, including, well, I think he has a reason too, but Eddie Hall, who broke the record.
Yeah.
He's not too happy about it.
You know, and that's the other thing. So this, it's old news now, but this boxing match,
is it real? Is it not? Are they friends?
I'm sure. I think it's what do they call it? Kayfabe. It was staged.
Mm-hmm.
They, because I mean, like, right after Thor did the lift, he issued the challenge. Like the day after, mm-hmm. Eddie Hall accepted the challenge, mm-hmm. and then immediately there was a date and a time and an arena and whatnot established.
It was pretty fast,
You know, so like...
I think it could go that fast, though, in real life. I don't know.
I think that...
I don't know if the Vegas thing would have came to fruition so quickly.
I don't think you're going to get all of the contracting in place for ticket sales and rights and stuff to that. Like, that's a couple of... that's a couple of month process.
Right.
So I think they've been doing it and they've been trying to build up the...
hype over. If you look at the Instagram pages, though, it's like, gosh, they're wasting a lot of time with the boxing stuff. I don't want to see the boxing match. I want to see them break world records in deadlifting. I want them to focus all their energy. They're 30 years old. They're getting older every day. I don't want them to waste a year of their life on this boxing match. I want them to break more records and bring more people to the sport.
I don't think Eddie's breaking any more records.
I don't know.
I think he's done with competition. I don't know. I think his wife won't let him do it anymore.
She's not too happy about it. She wants to see it end, but I don't think he's done yet.
I don't think
he's a competitive guy. He has a problem being competitive.
Yeah.
He grew up with brothers.
He's going to...
He's a pretty aggressive guy.
I don't know. Like, all of those guys, when I watch...
He's only 30. How old is he?
I don't know, but it's not the years. It's the mileage. And just carrying that much weight...
Yeah, he talked about it in the movies. If I carry this around until I'm 50, I'm dead.
Well, and, like, the other thing is...
It's so the weight and the steroids as well.
Taking the weight. You can't sleep well. All of those guys are on CPAP machines because they can't lift their chest unconsciously when they're trying to breathe. Yeah. So that is putting that much food through your internal organs has got to, like, I don't know how much mileage you get
in the
gut, but I mean, they put five times as much food through their gut.
Yeah, Rich Piana, the guy who made that shake with you, I was talking about Rich Piana. He died a couple of years ago. That was a big loss for the bodybuilding world.
Yeah.
He was doing it for 20 some years or something like that. They said when they did an autopsy, his heart was 8 times the size of an average human heart.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, it's got to be the steroids.
Oh, yeah. It is. It's all the steroids. Right. You build so much muscle that your heart has to get so big. It's just, all the heart is a pump.
Yeah.
So as your muscles get bigger, bigger and bigger, and your calves get bigger, all your extremities get bigger, you got to pump all that much more blood around your body. So his heart was 8 times the size of an average human's when he died. That's insane.
Yeah. And so it's not a healthy lifestyle.
Right.
It's an amazing.
It wears you out fast.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's mileage, like you said.
Yeah. So I don't think.
It's work. All it is work. You look at the amount of work the heart is producing over a lifetime. It's probably conservative.
Well, your
heart's capable of doing so much work. Right, or energy output per lifetime. And if you pack that into a body that's 400 pounds, you're just putting that much more workout per day.
Yeah.
And you only produce so much energy. It's conservative, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Your heart's going to produce so much energy that it's going to die.
Yeah. And, I don't know. So, like, with all of those things, there's got to be so many health problems that those guys just can't, you know, they can't maintain that forever.
Right.
And they got to drop weight at some point.
Yeah.
But... Yeah.
And you're talking about the steroid stuff, too. I think it's a tragedy. You're seeing a lot of, like, kids now using them. They get into the gym now. The kids these days, in general, are using drugs at a lot earlier age. I've heard of kids out west in Vegas using, like, ecstasy and stuff when they're in sixth grade. You know, hardcore narcotics.
Yeah.
Sixth and eighth grade. It's getting younger and younger.
Well, and with the
for us, it was high school.
Yeah, and with the steroids, it's like, okay, if you're in high school and you're doing, like...
Kids do it in high school.
They're
18-year-olds are taking massive amounts of testosterone.
Which is ridiculous because they got so much testosterone going crazy.
You know, they don't realize they're completely jacking up their system.
Oh,
yeah. And they'll never have kids if they do that because they're shutting down their natural supply.
Yeah.
And they're going to be 25 years old with zero sperm count. And that's a tragedy if you want to have families.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to have that.
But the other thing is, like, you're not getting as much benefit out of it. So
you're not, right.
If
you don't need it when your sperm, when your testosterone counts are 2,000.
Yeah. And if you're
18 years old.
If you're working out 8 hours a day doing bodybuilding and whatnot, you're gonna get your body to a level where it just can't do anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like the natural bodybuilders.
Yes, you see it a lot. Those guys.
If you want to get bigger, you've got to do something. They take steroids and then they continue to do 8 hours of workouts every day. Like, they're putting in the work.
Oh yeah, oh, yeah. You don't get big off taking steroids. You get big from putting in the more work and eating more.
Yeah, and so it's not like they're. They're taking the easy route. The kids in high school who are taking steroids, they're looking for the easy route.
Yeah.
You know, the professionals who are doing it, they're not looking for an easy route. No. They're looking for...
They're working their asses off. Like, you look at The Rock or some of these guys, they're probably, you know, I don't want to accuse him. He doesn't come out publicly about that. But he's in incredible shape and likely using some kind of growth hormone or...
Well, all of these...
why wouldn't they? They're actors, right?
Yeah, these actors who are, you know, who spend 9 months getting ready for position... I can almost guarantee.
Why would you not?
If I was a betting man, I would say that they're doing steroids. And who cares? Because they're just trying to.
And the thing is, people think, oh, they're on steroids. They're getting big just because of that. But these guys are working their asses off. Nobody works harder than The Rock. He's up at 4 a.m. every day, working his ass off in his gym every single day.
But, like, Well, he's not competing in anything. Like, yeah,
he's also good in the movies.
And he's you want him to look good in the movies. That's what you know. That's what you're paying him for. Yeah. So let him do his job.
Right. So it's his body. He has the right to do what he wants. It now, looks awesome.
Yeah. Now, if you're a professional athlete and you're saying, "Oh no, I don't do any of that stuff," I'm like, well, okay, now you're starting to
It's a different
cross some ethical lines, I guess.
Yeah.
With it, but I don't know. I think it's too highly stigmatized. I think it would be a benefit to. I think it could be used in a way that is healthy, I guess, for lack of a better word, especially for some of these sports where they do a lot of training and a lot of events, you know, throughout their season, because the steroids help you recover.
Recovery time is drastically improved.
And all that stuff.
You're putting your body through so much stress and then you can't recover. That's one of the reasons why. The people on the juice can get so much bigger is because you're recovering in 24 hours. Hit the gym again, you're already fully recovered. Whereas with your when you're natural, when your sperm, you know, your testosterone levels are 300-400, you now all of a sudden your recovery takes 3 or 4 days. You're 40 years old. Now your recovery takes 3 or 4 days. You're sore for 3 or 4 days. And the guys that are on the gear are just, they're ready to go in 24 hours.
Yeah.
That's so a big part of it, too.
Yeah. And I mean, if it's monitored, if it's regulated, if you got a doctor who's working with you and
checking
your blood levels,
making sure your cholesterol's fine,
I'm sure
and you're comfortable not having kids anymore.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they can take do sonograms of your heart and check that health and say, all right, and your heart's getting enlarging, it's getting kind of crazy, and whatnot. I think it can be done, if you're not trying to just get ridiculously huge if you're just looking for recovery and
testosterone kind of therapy versus anabolic steroid use. There's a big
I think
they're both the same thing, but one is more for therapy and the other is, like you say, for a competition.
It's an interesting
thing that men don't talk about enough because we're afraid to a lot of times because of the stigma in society
of steroids,
of testosterone therapy or steroids, any kind of testosterone supplement a lot of guys are afraid to talk about because it is something that's looked down upon. Like, oh, this guy's, he's on therapy, he's on, he's on drugs. Or something like that. That's part of it, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird, weird stuff going on in the world. But, all right, we're kind of pushing the length of this, but I did want, there's a question that I ask everybody. So, I guess, what do you think, what are some small changes that you think would have a big effect in maybe the world of personal fitness or, in the creating enthusiasm for STEM or in the world of technology?
Mm-hmm.
We've seen, not a small change that we talked about in spaceflight is this shift to commercialization
of
the industry is going to make huge changes. It's a pretty big change, but it's a huge change. What do you think is a small change in the world that an individual could do to improve their life, their wellness, their well-being?
Yeah, I guess sort of trying to be different. There's so much of the same thing going on out there every day. We get into these patterns. We fall behind certain people. We listen to their ideas. We stick to these certain cultures. Thinking outside the box, I think, isn't done enough because sometimes people are afraid to think outside the box. Sometimes you're sitting in a meeting and you think of a new idea. You're afraid to raise the new idea in front of a bunch of highly experienced people. I think just being more confident in yourself and your own abilities would be a change. I don't know what the best way to go about that is. I think it's just trial and error of just having the courage to stand up and talk about what your ideas are and how you think you can make a change. A lot of times people are afraid to do that. I think, and that's my philosophy with the weightlifting thing, especially, to think outside the box. What's not there? What doesn't exist? And let's go and try to build it. Fuck, let's go to Home Depot, get some wood, and just try to slap it together and see if the concept even works. Just have the ability or the desire to do something small like that, and just not be afraid to try to take your idea to the next level, to take it from concept to actually fabricating a physical unit of some sort. And that I'm referring to the weightlifting thing,
of course.
But even in the field of rocket propulsion, there's a lot of out-of-the-box thinking you can do. You know, we've been doing the same thing since 1960. I constantly, you know, before I go to bed sometimes, I think, man, there must be a better way to cast a motor. You know, there must be a better way to do this process. To make a rocket motor case, why is the case so difficult to build? You know, that's really the essence of the rocket science behind solid rocket motors. Mm-hmm. It's the damn case. It's just a sewer pipe.
Yeah.
But it creates the most challenging part of building the rocket motor because it's got to survive all the pressure and it's got to be welded properly. And then it's got to be able to be mass produced. So I try to think of all these little areas for improvement and all of the different steps in the manufacturing process. I never get anywhere with that. I never landed anything great, but I like to fantasize about it at night, to think about it when I go to bed and think, is there some kind of chemical out there we're not thinking about? What about magnesium? Or what about iron or lead?
Yeah.
You know, what about stuff that we're afraid to use because of the environmental stuff? What if there's something better?
You know? So you're going to start making rocket cases out of Inconel or something like that?
I thought about hollowing out trees before and using some sort of like cellulose type, you know, ablator like that. But you know, would that hold the pressure? Is there a simple way that we're just completely overlooking that could cut like a tree is a bad example?
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to say maybe there's some really obvious smoking solution out there that is so great that we just haven't quite got there yet, and everybody's too afraid to bring that up.
Yeah,
is what I'm constantly thinking about.
So
look at every step in the manufacturing process and just say there's got to be a way to do this easier.
So to make big a small change would be to believe that your crazy idea might not be so crazy.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people, especially younger engineers, are you know, afraid to bring that kind of stuff up in bigger meetings and venues, because they're not so confident in their abilities. They don't have a lot of experience. But sometimes they have these, they come from different places in life, and they have different experiences. You know, some might have worked in a chicken farm where they saw some type of technology, you know, or, you know, worked in, you know, some sort of field that's completely different from rocket propulsion, but it has some sort of technology, the way they do things, that could be highly beneficial and drive down the cost and complexity of doing what we do.
Yeah.
In the rocket motor industry, anyways.
All right. Well, thanks, Joe. I appreciate you making some time to do this.
Oh, no problem.
Help me out with my hobby here.
Would you like the protein shake?
Yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Ten eggs. You got a long ways to go.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know what I'm doing, but this might get interesting. And thanks for being here, Joe.
Great. Yeah, no problem. Happy to be part of it.